and welcome back to The Commentator's Curse. My name's Ian Danter. This is the podcast that delves deep into the journeys that some of my commentary colleagues have made, whether they work in radio or television commentating on the beautiful game of football or whatever it may be. I've been commentating on football and other sports for local and national radio for over 20 years. Every colleague I meet in the press box has got a slightly different story to tell about how they came to be where they are. And there's plenty of previous episodes where you found this episode of The Commentator's Curse that you can dip into. The good thing about these episodes is that they're designed to be sort of timeless. They don't actually correspond to a specific week. You can listen to any of them, and they're pretty much, you know, not of the moment. So you can just listen to the stories that people are telling about their life and times. So you can find those previous episodes where you found this one. So let's get on with today's episode and welcome my two guests that are joining me. First up is a friend of mine who has been front and centre with the BBC for a number of years, but much like me, he started life on Capital Gold, but in a different territory to me. I was in Birmingham, he was up there in the northwest on Capital Gold, but he's a mainstay of radio and television on the BBC these days. Steve Wilson's on The Commentator's Curse. How are you, Steve?
I'm very well, thanks, Dan. So I wasn't in the northwest. Capital Gold.
Were you a London man then?
Yes. Yeah. I've never worked for the Northwest.
Well, we'll get to that. We'll get to the London aspect. And there's me thinking you as a super white army. You must have started in the
North. No, I never worked there. No.
Well, I don't know where this my other guest started, but he's certainly one of the rising stars of commentary in this country, working again on television and on radio. Much like Steve, he divides his time between working for national broadcasters in this country and also working for what's known as the World Feed, bringing commentaries for games around the world. And he's recently been doing his first major tournament for TalkSport, where I work, where he was front and centre at the European Championships. Joe Shannon's with us on The Commentator's Curse. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Dance. Hello, Steve. It's great to be on. I've been listening throughout the series and it's been fantastic. So a real honour to be asked to be on.
Well, we'll give you 5 minutes and see how you do, and then we'll review it from that point on. The funny thing is, Joe, I mean, there's me and Steve who are of a certain age. You know, let's have it right. We are, you know, over 40. Whereas you are one of the new breed. That I'm sure you'll accept that you're one of the new guys that are coming through. The relationship between people of my generation and your generation, it's really nice to see that people are dovetailing more. Been chatting to Seb Hutchinson on this podcast, who's much like you, you know, has come through the ranks. It's nice to know that, you know, there are people coming through, and there's a two-way street of acceptance of you know, people coming in rather than, well, I hope you don't feel that there's people who are kind of, you know, pushing you out or shunning you out because you happen to be the new kid on the block.
No, I think one of the great things that I've found from day one and that you really get from listening to the podcast is the camaraderie and the togetherness and the mutual respect between just about everybody. I mean, I don't think I've ever come across any fellow commentator, reporter, presenter, broadcaster where, you know, there's ever been a cross word, really. And I think that really says something. You know, I remember kind of first local radio days where you're at your very first matches and you're nervous about everything from the interview with the manager after the game to plugging your ISDN in and making sure that works. And of course, you know, I'm still nervous about making sure the ISDN works. I'm still nervous about interviewing the manager after the game. But I remember seeing people at grounds like people like Nigel Pearson, like yourself and many others from those very early days. And there's just that level of helpfulness, that mutual respect. And, you know, I think that you make friends in and out of the commentary box. You know, you see people socially, you see people at games. And I think that is across the as you say, the generations, if you like, from the people that have been doing it for 30 years to the people who have been doing it for 3 years. I think everybody treats everybody as they would like to be treated themselves. We're all kind of full of mutual respect and admiration. And the great thing is that everybody does it slightly differently, different styles, has come through in different ways and has different ambitions. Yet what I think unites all of us is that camaraderie, that sense of mutual respect and that sense that this is a unique job. And I use the word job very loosely indeed. It's not really a job, is it? It's more a paid hobby than anything else, I think.
Well, yeah, after 20 plus years in this game, yeah, you do find yourself having to almost make excuses for the job that you do, when, friends, you are the jacksiest git on the planet, where you get to go and watch football. But they don't see the miles you travel to Hartlepool on a Tuesday night for a Papa John's Trophy quarterfinal, you know, thumping up the A1M thinking, I've been here before, about 50 times before. Steve, do you still get those little jangles of nerves that Joe talks about? You know, I know you don't have to worry about ISDN boxes quite so much now.
No, though I have had, I'm now so old, Dan, that I predate ISDN. I remember when ISDN came in, before that, it was some sort of enhanced kind of four-wire phone line thing at Capital, and I've had nightmares at Orient trying to get on air. Once at Goodison Park with Bobby Moore, actually, who obviously did Capital in the early 90s, and you know, literally with a screwdriver and bare bits of wire trying to work out if the green wire should be connected to the orange wire or the red wire to the blue wire to try and get on air. So I'm very happy that my lack of technical expertise is no longer at risk of knocking me off air. But Joe's right, and I've heard other people say this on here, is that, you know, it is still actually a relatively small pool of people who know what it is like to just pick up a microphone and start talking live when you have absolutely no idea what's going to happen. I remember, you know, John Motson, who was a great source of advice for me when I moved from radio to TV, said, you know, it's probably the longest unscripted broadcast anybody ever does, you know. And when you actually think about it, he's right. You know, anything from the, you know, fantastic to the tragic could happen before your eyes over the course of the next couple of hours. And it's your job to describe it. And these days with social media, obviously, if you put a foot wrong, then you will be you'll be well and truly castigated for it. So that ups the ante a bit. I don't get nervous often, I have to say. I don't get nervous. I just get a bit focused, probably.
I think that's probably, yeah, the adrenaline does kick in at some point where, you know, they're about to throw to you from the studio and, you know, you're about to pick up. You can feel that the body tensing a little bit because, you know, you've got to get that first couple of sentences correct. You know,
yeah, I don't want to chat about the weather 2 minutes before a World Cup quarterfinal, you know. That's not when you want to have that conversation.
There is that moment, though, isn't there? And I think, sorry, Dan, so I think it might have been Guy Mowbray talked about this earlier on in the series, but there is that moment in the few seconds, as Steve said, but before the handover, where there is that adrenaline rush. And even though you've done all your prep and it's in front of you, and you might have seen the teams last week or the month before, and you feel like you've done it enough times for that adrenaline rush to be one of pure excitement, there is a moment for me where I look down and I think, how am I going to get the words out? Is there going to be a moment where I'm tongue-tied? You know, am I going to be able to spot the numbers, usually on the back of the QPR or West Brom shirts, I hasten to add, in the six-yard box and make sure I nail the goal scorer? There is that fleeting moment of nerves. I wouldn't quite call it self-doubt, but it's certainly a big adrenaline rush in that moment where the presenter's doing that final little link before they hand over to you, I think.
I had that thing on Tuesday night when it went to penalties between Hartlepool and Charlton. And I couldn't quite see whether it was Jamie Sterry or Regan Ogle who was stepping up to take the fifth penalty, because I couldn't make out whether it was a 2 or a 20 on the back of those blessed shirts. You're right. I mean, that can completely mess with your head, the whole thing. Funny, you talk about, you know, you see two teams recently. You're right. I go back to last season when I did both legs of the semi-finals in the League Two playoffs between Newport and Forest Green. You couldn't have had two more different games if you tried in the space of 5 days. The second game of the new lawn was just nuts. It was driving horrible rain. Kevin Ellison scores a worldie from 35 yards out. It was 4-3 or whatever it was. A complete antithesis to the first game. So you're right. Unique sporting occasions is exactly right. You should never prejudge one game by the one you've done before, even if it's two to the two same teams you've done from a week before.
You know, I had Joe, I had one of those moments on Saturday, actually. Dance and I were at Elland Road for Leeds against Newcastle. And when I got to the ground and opened my file of notes about, I don't know, an hour and a half before kickoff or something, I'd done the second leg of the Arsenal-Liverpool League Cup semi-final on the Thursday night. And when I opened my file, my notes for Arsenal-Liverpool were still in the file. And my notes for Leeds Newcastle were nowhere to be seen. And I do everything on a computer. And I'd obviously done the work. I'd printed them off at home, which is in Sussex. So I couldn't nip home from Elland Road to go and get them. And I hadn't put them in the file. But luckily, I had my laptop in the back of the car and I could email them to John Simpson, who you both know, ex of West Brom, now of Premier League, who could print them off for me. But just for about 2 or 3 minutes there, I was, when I told you 5 minutes ago, I didn't suffer from nerves. That little 2 or 3 minutes was uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's not good. At a moment like that, Joe?
It's enough to put you into a cold sweat for sure. In terms of notes, thankfully not, although I touch wood, because I think we all have our own little routines, don't we? And you might pack your bag at the same time. You might do your notes in exactly the same way. I've had a couple of dices with danger in terms of getting to the ground on time for matches. Going to a game at Bournemouth once where I was doing reports and left what I thought to be early enough, but didn't reckon to. There's that, I forget the name of the A road, but there's a long road towards Bournemouth's ground that is probably only about 10 miles or so away. And I think it's a dual carriageway.
The A338, that's the one you're thinking of.
That's the one. Oh, I probably subconsciously tried to forget it and put it to the back of my mind, because I was sitting there in roadworks for a good hour or so, and I missed my 2 o'clock team news piece for reports and managed to get on air for 3 o'clock. But, you know, I think there's a big part of all of us in the commentary game where we are all perfectionists. So to get a word out of place in a commentary, to not quite call a goal right, or as you might have wanted to at the time, is bad enough. But to actually be so late to a game that you know, you miss a chunk of the program, or perhaps you even go on to miss kickoff, is one of those things that I think we all have nightmares about. And it actually almost happened again earlier this season at Bristol City, where it was a 7:45 kickoff. I left at midday and I had a 6.5 hour journey to the ground and I missed the start of our programme and managed to get on air in the end for the commentary. But, you know, it's the sort of moment that makes you think perhaps getting there 3 hours before isn't always enough. I always like to leave 3 hours before getting to a game, but perhaps I should start to leave 5 or 6 or something like that, because it's the worst kind of pit of your stomach feeling, isn't it?
I've been there. I've mentioned before on this podcast about missing the first 15, 20 minutes of Bolton against West Brom because there was an accident on the M61 and I could see the Reebok Stadium, as it was known then, to my right-hand side, but I was about half a mile from getting off the motorway. But they'd shut it, and there's no worse feeling than that powerless feeling.
Having said that, though, guys, weren't there some support? I can't remember what team they were supporting, but in the sort of pan-European Euros that we had last summer, weren't there a group of fans who went to Budapest instead of Bucharest? There's not much you can do about that, is there?
I'm sure they still saw a game.
That's a bit like, that's a little like a Coventry City ground showing at St Andrews situation. I remember getting prepped for a commentary, Coventry against Tranmere, I think it was, for TalkSport 2 a couple of seasons ago. And not really, and actually, you know, doing my prep and writing down St Andrews and, you know, getting all that ready. And it wasn't until the morning where I was due to sort of sitting in my car, sat nav on, ready to leave. And I had the Rika Arena in my sat nav, and something in my brain just clicked and said, this isn't right. And of course, thankfully, you know, big sigh of relief, it clicks that actually the game's taking place at St Andrews. But it just goes to show, I think, so often that in the, you know, you've said it, Dance, that bizarre, weird world that we inhabit, you can kind of never double check things too many times.
It happens to me as well. I had a mate of mine who, when my heroes Kiss were playing at the the Barclaycard Arena in Birmingham a couple of years ago. That's the one that's in the city centre. There's two arenas in Birmingham. There's the one that used to be called the NIA, which where they used to show gladiators, you know, back in the day. And then there's the NEC Arena. And about, I mean, Kiss are playing at about 9 o'clock. About 7:30, my mate texts me. He says, God, it's quiet in this car park. He's gone to the NEC. He's parked in the NEC Arena car park. He's wondering where all the punters are. You know, it was a sold-out show. So he had to make a mad dash. It's only 8 miles, but he barely got to the NIA in time to see the gig. So it happens all over the place. What were you going to say there, Steve?
I'm pretty certain the lovely Tracy, who's a legend at Five Live, who did all the travel booking for radio, I'm pretty certain Roddy Forsyth was once booked on a plane to Parma, Spain, when Rangers were playing Parma in the UEFA Cup or something years ago. I mean, it was corrected in time, but in those days, like paper tickets and stuff, the paper arrived and he said, you're sending me to a Spanish holiday resort rather than...
Not that Roddy would have complained, I'm sure, in the show.
No, he probably would have done both trips, actually.
Exactly. Yeah. No, right, let's go back to beginnings, if I may, gentlemen. I'll start with you, Steve. I mentioned that I got it completely wrong about where you ended up in terms of your capital goal, but where did the seed of commentary, the seed of wanting to get into this particular industry begin for you?
Well, I suppose, as a kid, I used to have it was like a cheap version of Sabutio called Big League that you played on the carpet. It was basically Sabutio, but the players looked a little bit different. You pulled their legs back. There was Striker as well, wasn't there? Do you remember
Striker?
Well, I had Big League, which was kind of like the poor version of Striker, which was the poor version of Sabutio. And I used to commentate along to that and write match reports and do FA Cup draws and play all these games. I was a strange kind of child. But I mean, to be honest with you, I suppose I went to university, to Surrey University, to study God knows why, hotel and catering management. And the only thing I learned in my 18 months there before it all went wrong was how to operate a radio desk, because I got involved with a student radio station there, playing music, playing my music. So this wasn't anything to do with sport. I was DJing badly, I'm sure. And then I managed to sort of resurrect a university degree by changing and going to Liverpool Uni, where I did English language and literature, which is what I should have done all along, really. And whilst I was there, I got involved in writing for the student newspaper. And there were three of us did the football on that. Mike Hughes, who's now the sports editor of Radio Merseyside, David Anderson, who reports on football in Yorkshire for the Mirror, and me. So we all did pretty well out of that. Off the back of that bit of experience in my final year at Liverpool, I applied for a postgraduate BBC news journalism trainee scheme. And I had no idea how sort of big a pool I was in, but I got through kind of a couple of local stages and ended up going to the BBC's training college, which then was just near Oxford Circus. And this was like a final interview. And I didn't get on it. It didn't go well at all. I haven't got time for the horrible things that they asked me. Who's your least favourite BBC television journalist and why? That's a hard question. Anyway, I didn't get on it, but luckily for me, I had another job in London and with a publishing company, but I wanted to get involved in radio. I discovered Capital Gold Sport on my radio and I sent them a tape of me doing a sort of fake match report and a CV. And I was really lucky that there was a guy called Pete Simmons who was at Capital, who was the sports producer, who was an absolute genius producer. And he knew more about the BBC interview process than I did. And he kind of said, do you realize you probably got through to about the last 50 from a pool of about 5,000, you know? And I had absolutely no idea. And he took that as a bit of a plus and gave me a chance. So
what year was that, Steve?
1990 I started. Yeah, 1990. I graduated from Liverpool in 1990. I just wanted to move to London. I didn't really have any great idea of what I wanted to do other than live in London. So I just applied for, I bought the Media Guardian every Monday and applied for more or less anything that was in London to do with any kind of media. continuity announcer on Radio 4 I applied for.
I can hear that.
And in those days, I probably had quite a Scouse accent. So it was in the days before accents were sort of appreciated on the BBC.
Oh, no, no. We can go back to Wilfred Pickles post-war. You could have been a latter-day Wilfred Pickles, Steve.
Maybe. Anyway, so that's why I never worked in the Northwest, really, because I just wanted to live in London.
Right.
And I thought I'd give it a year probably and see what happens. And I've lived in London or Sussex ever since 1990. So.
Well, this is where Joe Shannon scares us both by saying he wasn't even born in 1990.
Well, do you know, I am so interested in Joe because I often get asked by people, you know, students at colleges or whatever stage of their kind of, you know, nascent career they're at, you know, I get asked for my advice of how to get in. Now, I'm 54, so I always say to them, listen, you know, the course that you're doing now, just those courses didn't exist when I was your age. So my route in might be the kind of same route as the dinosaur made to this kind of watering hole, you know. I'm interested to know how Joe got in, because I can sort of possibly pass that on to people of the best way to do it now.
Because Joe, you were a commentator in your bedroom as well as a young lad, weren't you, with a tape recorder, was that right?
We are all a bit strange, aren't we? I always like to think my first game was actually the then... I think the season before it was renamed the Championship, the 2003-2004 Division One playoff semi-final first leg between Palace and Sunderland. I think Andy Johnson scored once or possibly twice. And I did it on one of the old tape recorder things, you know, 11-year-old me. It's probably still there somewhere in the ether. It's always fascinating, you know, you always think kind of how do you come up with that desire to become a football commentator? Where does it kind of get imbued with you? And I think it's a really hard thing to try and explain and delve into. You know, for me, it kind of felt like, can you learn to be a commentator? Can you get taught to be a commentator? Yes, of course you can improve. Yes, of course there are the things that we like to think are the basics of football commentary, but so much of it I think comes from the heart. And where does that come from? Well, you know, for me, it felt like from hours and hours of just kind of being around the radio, watching games on Sky on the television, listening to, and it was mostly Five Live when I was, you know, little and Alan Green and Mike Ingham and Conor McNamara and Ian Dennis and many others. And it kind of just gets imbued in you by a kind of weird commentary osmosis. You know, do you learn to be a football commentator, or do you kind of pick up? Do you absorb that knowledge? Do you absorb those little quirks, those little changes in the voice, those modulations? I don't know if I have the answer, but for me, you know, it comes, I think, from listening to the greats, from listening to the people who are at the top of the game at the time. You know, you're kind of just learning, you've got an interest in commentary. And anyway, that was how I felt when I was little. And then I think in terms of when I decided that this was something that I was really interested in, I think actually I took quite a traditional route. Started off at Wickham Hospital Radio, which is my local hospital radio station, run by a guy called Keith Higgins, who gave me the chance to commentate on matches at Adams Park and do a bit of summarising and do those half of a half commentaries, which was always the exciting thing.
How old would you have been at that point?
At that point, I think I was very lucky to have the chance to do it, because I know that not many hospital radio stations either do sport or certainly do sports commentary. I was about 17, 18. So this was just before university. So it was invaluable experience getting those commentary hours, that mileage under my belt before I'd even gone to university. And then I went to Warwick and I did a history degree. So again, you know, the fascinating thing is listening to this podcast is there is no traditional route. Everybody does it differently, whether it be through a degree, through hospital radio. You can get into it at 18. You can get into it 10, 20 years later. But I feel I took what was quite a traditional route of doing hospital radio, went to university, we had a great student radio station. So I was able to do commentaries on the varsity football matches. We did a 90-minute commentary, which was a really exciting experience. And then while I was there, I managed to get some experience at my local station, BBC Three Counties Radio, which was a great help. And Jeff Doyle, who is still the sports editor, was tremendous for me. And it was there that I did my first you know, what you might call proper paid for live football commentary, Wickham against Fleetwood, in early 2014. And, you know, and things just spiral from there. I finished my degree. I met a brilliantly helpful and still a mentor of mine, a guy called Charles Runcie, who used to sort of run BBC Local Radio Sport, who I'm sure you guys know. And he told me there was an opening at BBC Radio Derby for a Burton Albion commentator to do Burton Albion matches. And it was kind of from there that that sort of things really seemed to sort of slowly kick into gear.
It's funny, you talk about, you know, the voices that imbue you with that that desire somehow subconsciously to then become a commentator in later life. Steve and I are a very similar age. And it's funny, they just posted up on Twitter this morning, it's 49 years to the day today since Gareth Edwards scored one of the greatest tries ever for the Barbarians against New Zealand.
What a score!
Cliff Morgan was doing the commentary that day for the BBC, and he wasn't the regular rugby commentator. Bill McLaren was meant to do it, either he was poorly or something. So Cliff Morgan, who was a vastly experienced operator within the BBC Sport Network, but hadn't done much live commentary, was thrust into the commentator's chair, and he provided the most sublime commentary on this brilliant try right at the start of the match. And I think Steve and I were just fortunate. I mean, we'll get onto your influences, Joe, but we had Bill McLaren, Murray Walker, Alan Weeks, and of course John Motson, Barry Davis, and people like that in football. But
Peter Jones was the one for me, really. Radio 2. Peter Jones and Brian Butler were a fabulous team, weren't they? And Brian Butler was like the wordsmith and the kind of voice piece writer, if you like, you know. But Peter Jones was an absolute poet, and just an incredible football commentator on the incredible commentator of anything on the radio. You know, the GOAT, basically, Peter Jones. Yes, you're right. And, you know, every generation has its people like that, I suppose. I think the difference is that the era that we're talking about, you know, in the 70s, I guess, is that it was a much smaller pool, wasn't it? Because, you know, local radio was relatively new, I suppose, in the mid-70s. You know, thinking about Capital, I think, started in 73 or something like that. Yeah. Independent ILR was relatively new, and football was covered so much less than it is these days. So there were less jobs, weren't there, really?
Yeah, well, there
were. Fewer jobs, yeah.
I always like the guys who were versatile. Like, well, you know, I've been lucky enough to speak to Barry Davis on this podcast, who did a whole multitude of sports. And somebody like Alan Weeks, who would do football, but would also do ice dancing and the ice skate.
Yes,
And ice hockey as well, and things like that. So I always like the guys who...
But that was a requirement of the BBC in those days. Like when I joined the BBC from Capital, I'd only done football at Capital. You know, obviously that's basically what we covered. And I have to say, you know, my knowledge of sport is, I consider myself to be something of an expert at football, and to be a guy propped up at the bar with almost every other sport. You know, I like my cricket, I like my rugby, but I'm no expert. But when you went to Five Live in those days, I'm not sure if this is still the case, but Joanne Watson, who was sort of Five Live, one of the senior producers there, was absolutely insistent that everybody had to have another sport. And it's really interesting seeing, I can see behind Joe on the Zoom, the Commonwealth Games poster for Manchester in 2002. Now, I joined the BBC in 98 and they tried me out with various sports, swimming. I was absolutely terrible swimming commentator. Awful.
Why?
Because nothing happens, Dan. It's like they all jump in. The one who's going to win is always in lane 4 or lane 5. After about 10 meters, they're in front. No one ever overtakes anybody. And it's, you know, what do? They just, nothing happens. You've no chance of a pitch invader or anything, you know? So it's just a very hard sport. I found it a very hard sport to commentate on. And actually, we had a meeting with Manchester 2002 Commonwealth Games. where we were told, we weren't consulted, we were told what our sport was going to be. And I got hockey, which I thought was decent because it's football with sticks, yeah. isn't it, really? And I remember, I think it was David Oates, you know, God bless him. And I came out of the meeting and Oatesy had found out a little earlier what he was doing. He was doing taekwondo or something. And he said, how do you know when they score? You know, at least in hockey, the ball goes in the net. You know, like we really didn't know anything about it. But this was some months before and you had some time to kind of get up to speed. And I went and watched a lot of hockey and people who played for GB at the time, actually the goalkeeper was very helpful teaching me sort of the intricacies of the sport. And actually, when I got to Manchester, I really quite enjoyed it. But I didn't know anything about hockey when it was allocated to me, not a thing. So in those days, back in that time, you know, it was very much you weren't encouraged to be a one sport man.
It's a good thing. You know, variety is the spice of life. And certainly the chance I got to do cricket for TalkSport in 2017 was exciting, but utterly terrifying at the same time. I'd grown up watching so much cricket with my dad because my dad very nearly played for Warwickshire at the back end of the 50s. He was in the second team for Warwickshire, having done his national service, and was in the same squad as players like Jack Bannister and Dennis Amos and MJK Smith, but he just didn't quite make the grade. But he was a fantastic club cricketer. Now, my dad passed away in 2008, but I know he would have found it intensely funny that I was asked to commentate on the ICC Champions Trophy. And the comfort I have in working with the pundits that I work with in football is fine. You know, I don't feel intimidated in any way by working with football pundits, but there was something about sitting next to Sir Clive Lloyd or Ramiz Raja that absolutely petrified me, because I'm thinking, if I put a word out of place here, they're going to see me as this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And of course, it's a different discipline, cricket commentary anyway. So that was the most wonderful learning curve at that stage in my career. You know, that's nearly 20 years in, and you realise at that point, you've still got an awful lot to learn about the art of commentary. Mm-hmm. But I
was going to say, I've really loved the... similarly to Steve, I've really loved the kind of, and to you, Dan, I've loved the fleeting experiences that I have had so far with doing sports other than football. I've done quite a lot of tennis on the radio so far for ATP Tennis Radio.
Good luck to you with that.
Which is a challenge and a completely different style of broadcasting. But is nonetheless, the novelty of it has been a really kind of rewarding, fascinating experience, and perhaps it's because you're tackling a different sport, different structure, different rules, you're getting to work with different pundits. But I think it's that sheer kind of the difference between a football commentary and a tennis commentary. There is a heck of a lot between the two of them, and I found it a really refreshing challenge to have. The one kind of challenge of a different sport which was with retrospect enjoyable but at the time was a little more stressful was covering the British Shooting Championships for television one year. Thankfully, it was all pre-recorded, because when it comes to type of shotguns or, you know, the leading stars in the ranks of the British Shooting Championships, with all due respect to them, I wasn't particularly knowledgeable. It was a case of being sent a sort of script the night before, a video of what I was going to commentate over, and trying to make sense of what was in front of me, and trying to make sure that what I was spewing out of the microphone vaguely tallied with what was going on the pictures. It was a unique challenge, but I think all these challenges, and I think kind of branching out into different sports and trying things, really, even if it is for a day or a couple of hours, like the British Shooting Championships was, I think it can often make for rewarding, if slightly nerve-wracking, experiences.
Just saying shooting championships multiple times would worry me that I would be on the precipice of something. I remember getting an email once from a show in Australia, Hamish and Andy, who are kind of an Australian version of Ant and Dec, I suppose, and that's probably pigeonholing them a little too easily. There's more to them than that. But they had this this show where they were going, that it was Hamish and Andy's world tour of Asia or Europe or the States or something, but they were having these strange races and they needed a commentator to commentate on these strange races. About races like, there was one when they were in the Far East called Sweat Racing, where they were put in plexiglass boxes, the two of them, and the boxes had a little funnel at the bottom that went through to a jug, and they had sweat. And whoever sweat the most was the winner, and I've got to commentate on this. And they're getting ill, you know, because the sun's beating down wherever they are, Thailand, Bangkok, wherever it may be. But it was funny because they sent these scripts through, and it was so very brilliantly written. You actually partridged it up a little bit so that you went along with the humour rather than being too straight about it. That was great fun to do something like that, completely out of my comfort zone. But it was more like comedy than commentary. But hell, I don't know, somehow it informed, you know, making sure that you don't go into any sport too seriously. You can't do darts commentary too seriously. You've got to have a sense of humour and play along with the sheer lunacy of the sport at times. It's an amazing place to be when you're at a darts match, Steve. It's like nowhere else when you go to Ali Pally.
It's one I've never done. And do you have someone in your ear telling you it's double 17,
no,
triple
no,
five or whatever? No, Sky, you've got to do all the maths.
The TV guys have a spotter. So if you're working for Sky Television, then it's usually, I think it's Keith Deller. It used to be
dear. Yeah, okay.
It used to be dear old Eric Bristow who did it. Or there's Colin Lloyd who does it now, Jaws Lloyd. But for us on the radio, no, we are purely reliant. We're side onto the stage, so we can see the players throwing in profile. We have the TV monitor that shows us the pitches that are going out to the viewing public.
Yeah.
And we also have, like they're having cricket, a kind of a fruit machine.
Okay.
Shows you how many 180s they've hit, how many ton plus scores, how many 140s they've hit. Their double average, what are they like on hitting doubles? But no, you don't get, you've got to work it out for yourself. And of course, you've got guys like Chris Mason and Paul Nicholson sat next to you, PDC players who know
players instinctively.
But you still have to, watch their eyes. We do anyway. You watch when they're approaching a finish, right? Are they looking treble 15 or are they actually looking at treble, you know, treble 9 or whatever?
Right.
So you've actually got to try and preempt where they're going to go. And more often than not, the camera actually pans out to show the whole board at sometimes because they don't, the spotters don't know where a player's going to go. So there's an element of guesswork. But I love that. It means you've got to do maths on the fly. My maths has come on an absolute bomb in the last 4 years. It's amazing. but there we go. Steve, Capital Gold. And you arrived at Capital Gold in London at almost the perfect time, it seems to me, for the rise of independent local radio. Yeah. Football rights and
absolutely.
And what that led to. An amazing time. And you mentioned working with Bobby Moore, England's World Cup winning captain, who Jonathan Pierce kind of rescued from almost anonymity because no other broadcaster was utilising him.
Well, the story, I arrived at Capital in late 1990, so just after the Italian World Cup. But as I understand it, Bobby started working for Capital in Italy at the World Cup in 1990. Capital, I think, got you know, a share of radio rights quite late in the day from FIFA and didn't have, I don't know who the football pundits were. They'd only been on air for like a season or something, maybe a season and a half, and as a sports station. And literally, I think Jonathan or somebody anyway, it could have been Richard Park, the famous radio Richard Park, who was a scary man. But it could have been him. Somebody anyway went to the FA and said, listen, you know, we need an England pundit to take to Italy for the World Cup. You've obviously got the contacts with former England players. It needs to be a former England player. Who do you suggest? And they said, I don't think anyone's taking Bobby Moore. And that's how it happened. But you're right. I mean, Capital was basically, aside from taking out the BBC, National BBC Radio, it was the biggest sports radio station in the country. So at Capital, where I was working with Jonathan, Mick Lowe's, Dave Clark, later Rob Watton, Julian Waters, people who've all gone on to have really, really, you know, good careers. It was a fantastic working place to learn. But it was the only ILR station where you would go to the World Cup. I went to the World Cup in 1994. I went to the Atlanta Olympics in 96. Now, that wasn't necessarily full commentary rights. In fact, it wasn't full commentary rights. But what they used to do, they would supply sponsored bulletins for the ILR network, working in tandem with John Anderson at IRN, Guy Swindles. And so we would do, for example, in Atlanta, we basically covered the whole Olympic Games with two people. Me and Dave Clark, you know, covered the Atlanta Olympics. And we still got to the bombing in Centennial Olympic Park before the BBC, by the way, because our hotel was about 100 yards away. And no other radio station would do that. So then you'd provide these kind of three or four updates a day. Atlanta was LucasAid, so it would be kind of like, you know, Atlanta, the Olympics, 1996, Atlanta, with LucasAid, the whatever it was, you know, designed to make you sweat, you know, whatever it is, whatever the tagline was. And then you'd have this sort of, you know, day three at the Olympics, you know, blah, 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 the headlines. And we would do a bit of sort of like commentary into tape machines on events so that we could use those in the bulletin. In the desk I'm sitting at somewhere is a CD of my commentary on what I would actually say is seriously in 30 years, the greatest sporting event I've ever seen, which was Michael Johnson's world record winning 400 meters at Atlanta, where he knocked about a second off the world record, which is vast, you know. Mm-hmm. And so having earlier said I didn't get the chance to do anything other than football at Capital, that's not quite true, because I did some athletics. Not live, but Capital was huge, absolutely huge. I was there for 7 years and I should have left a year before I did. By the time I left, I was desperate to leave, absolutely desperate. I was applying to the BBC sort of on an almost constant basis. And I felt that, you know, there was lots of reasons that I wanted to move on. I wished I'd gone after Euro 96. I stayed for another 15 months, but finally I got to where I wanted to do, which was basically to get onto Five Live. I had to actually go freelance in order to do it. And Charlie Runcie, who Joe mentioned before, I'd applied probably twice, three times to the BBC, never, always got an interview, never got in. And Charlie said to me, you have to leave Capital. So people here know you from what you're like on air, but they've no one here has ever worked with you. And at that time, I think it's less, much less now, the BBC tended to recruit from within. After all, that's kind of what local radio is there for, to provide talent for the national radio. And he said, you have to leave. If you are willing to leave Capital, I will make sure that you get two shifts a week working on Five Live and people will get to know you. It's your job to find other work elsewhere. And I ended up working for TWI and IMG and various people, had 8 months or so as a freelance, and I really enjoyed it. Did my first TV work in that time. But it meant that then when the next job came up and I applied for it, that the people who were interviewing me knew me and had worked with me. And I don't think without that advice from Charlie, I ever would have got in.
Now, Joe, you mentioned going to work on Burton Albion games for BBC Radio Derby. What did that experience teach you? And based on what Steve's just been talking about there with, you know, what opportunities that then provided for you?
Oh, it was probably the most important 3 years, in a sense, that I'll ever have in the game, if you like, in commentary, because it really taught me some of how to become a commentator, how to become a journalist. You know, I went into it very fortunate, I think, as well, that at that time, the 3 years I did it, 2014 to 2017, Burton had the most remarkable footballing success on the pitch. They went from League Two to League One to the Championship, and they stayed up in the Championship, which, you know, was, I think, a helpful pattern of events along the way. It brought them to, you know, at times kind of national levels of attention. But for me, it was, these were kind of formative years where I learned how to commentate. I learned how to operate equipment. I learned how to interact and dovetail with a summarizer. I learned how to interview players and managers. That was something that was extremely nerve-wracking, I think, particularly at the start. And I had the great benefits of interviewing, when I was at Burton, the three managers that I had, Gary Rowett, Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank, and Nigel Clough, all of whom are great, affable people, easy to chat to, easy to interview. I do remember my second ever game as Burton Albion commentator, a 2-1 win at home to Dagenham, going to speak to Gary after the game. And Burton kind of pre-season had been billed as potential League Two favourites, or at least there was a sense they'd definitely be up there. And I went up to Gary, and I think my next to last or last question or something like that was, you've come back to beat Dagenham at home, Gary. Is this the mark of potential promotion winners? And he turned to me and he said, I cannot believe you have used that word two games into the league's season. Mm-hmm. And he said it in a very gentle, comforting, very Gary Rowett way. There was nothing malicious meant about it. But for me, it was a very early sense that, you know, I'd come in thinking, oh, I can do this commentary lark and it's great fun. And the commentaries were great. But what it really taught me was that I had a heck of a lot of learning and growing up to do. I mean, I was just out of university. And when it came to things like that, you know, and coming onto a patch where there were lots of experienced East Midlands journalists who'd known this club for years and had known Gary for years. And, you know, here I was, this young guy from the South coming up and, you know, intruding and leading these interviews. You know, it did teach me that, you know, if I wasn't completely out of my depth in some senses, I had a lot to learn. And I really do treasure the nature of those 3 years.
Well, who was your summariser for those three years?
Well, this was an interesting thing because at Burton Albion, I didn't have an ex-player. I had a long-standing supporter, Tony Bentley, his name, a lovely guy who worked with me throughout the 3 years. And very seldom, unless Tony was away, did I actually work with an ex-pro. But Tony knew everything there is to know about Burton Albion. He could tell me that, you know, this player had signed 3.5 years ago and since then had made 20 substitute appearances, of which 10 had lasted 25 minutes. And the other, you know, he was an encyclopedia of knowledge, which certainly helped. But as Burton rose through the divisions and as I racked up those hours, you know, I gained a confidence. I didn't feel like an imposter anymore. And those experiences, I think, of following one club, particularly on this kind of pretty unique rise up the divisions, is something that, look, I love what I do now, but every now and then you have those little kind of pangs back to the past. And I almost miss it at times, that experience of following a club round, and particularly Burton when they reached the championship, they were underdogs in every game. You get to know the players, you get to know the manager, Nigel Clough, absolutely great guy, lovely man. And you really feel a sense of excitement, of camaraderie that you're, in Burton Albion's case, really living through a unique period of history in the club. And I always think that one of the most satisfying things about being a commentator in those early days would be a Tuesday night game where Burton would play away to a club like a Sheffield United or a Newcastle United or an Aston Villa. And if they got a result, you know, you'd drive home on those long journeys down on the motorway thinking, yep, job done. I'm really loving this. I'm really enjoying this. I get to commentate every week on a football club that is making its own history, rising up through the leagues. People were saying they had no right to be in the championship. And here they were against the odds staying in it. And I just thought it was the most fantastic story. And, you know, I'll always look back on that, whatever happens, as the most kind of most fortunate start. You know, I was very, very lucky.
I don't know what Steve has experienced in anything similar to that. I know I had something similar in my early days at Capital Gold following Walsall, because they had not quite the same journey as Burton, but certainly getting to the championship under Ray Graydon and staying there under Colin Lee was quite the story for the West Midlands patch, because, of course, it was so much about Villa. And of course, West Brom and Blues trying to get out of the championship, and Wolves, you know, trying to get out of the championship. But the Walsall story was a lovely footnote, but it just grew and grew and grew. So it was terrific for me to be part of that and watch the development of the club. But when it starts to go wrong, as it did start to go wrong for Walsall, when Colin Lee was jettisoned and they brought in Paul Merson for the season where they got relegated. Some of those, you mentioned those trips, those long trips, Joe, you take when you know, they've won and you drive back, yeah, this feels good. When you've gone to Norwich as the Walsall commentator and seen them get walloped, Paul Merson's Walsall getting walloped, 4-0 at least it was, Paul McVeigh in incredible form for an hour, and that's a long drive home because you just watch the most demoralising performance and you think, oh, these are toast. They're done. They're just, you know, stick a fork in them. It's all over. But Steve, have you had a... I mean, with Five Live, of course, you're like me. You just flip between club to club. You don't really...
No, I haven't. No, my very early days at Capital, I was... this would be about 91, something like that. I was kind of... I did Fulham and Brentford alternate weeks. And at that time, Alan Dix was the Fulham manager and they were as low as they'd ever been in the Football League pyramid. You know, tiny crowds at Craven Cottage. Brentford were on the up. They had Phil Holder in charge who... and they had a great side, actually. They had Marcus Gale, Keith Jones, Gary Blissett, Dean Holdsworth. It was that Brentford team. And I don't know whether you two remember this, but one of the most significant moments that I will never forget is when, you know that time when the first time anyone in football calls you by your name without you having just told them your name, you know? Well, that man for me was Phil Holder. And that was interviewing him when Brentford were, I think, third tier. And it was the year they got promoted into the second tier. And Phil Holder, you know, it was just a magical moment. You know, I went to go and interview him with my little Marantz reel-to-reel tape thing, you know, proper reel, quarter-inch tape on reels, portable thing. And it was like, you know, well, that was a good win. Phil, congratulations. And he went, yeah, well, Steve, I thought we did really well, Phil. And I was like, my God, he just called me Steve. And I didn't say, I haven't just said to him, oh, Steve Wilson from Capital Gold. Honestly, I could practically have just melted with joy on the spot. But I do think what Joe touched on then, and Dan, you're saying about Walsall, is that, you know, it's doing literally, I think the people who probably succeed in this industry, maybe you have to do your time, don't you? You have to do your time, and that is literally miles on the clock, but or just games under your belt, and do those things. Like at Capital, it was such a close-knit team and we got on so well, but you would I don't know, drive to Blackburn from London to go and watch Spurs at Blackburn on a Tuesday night, drive back to London immediately after the game, go into Euston Tower with your post-match interviews, edit them up, put them onto cart for whoever's doing the breakfast bulletin. So he's got his little 20 seconds of Steve Perryman, whoever it is, and then go home and then be back in the office at 10 o'clock the next morning, having maybe got in home at sort of 4 a.m, you know, and then you do your shift and probably be down the pub together after the next day's work, you know, and it became a very, very tight... we were a really tight-knit group. And the one I forgot to mention earlier, who I have to mention, because I actually think, Peter Jones aside, I think Mick Lowes is the best radio football commentator I've ever heard. He was at Capital when I came. And I benefited in a way because he left and went off to go to Nottingham initially, which is where he was from. And that opened up a gap in terms of commentary for me to kind of, you know, come in at the bottom of that little ladder. But Losey was a fabulous radio commentator. And I'll be honest here, Dan, I think he experienced the same frustrations as I did some years later, is that Capital was very much about Jonathan Pearce. And if you were doing your job well, then you were a good Jonathan Pearce impersonator. Basically, you know, if you did your job well, the audience thought you were Jonathan Pearce. If you did it badly, they'd say, where's Jonathan Pearce? Yeah. And that really, you know, that's not a reflection of my relationship with Jonathan. We were very, very close for that period of time. But it is massively frustrating. And it wasn't a style of commentary that I wanted to particularly do. It was, you know, it was, I felt I got to the point where I needed to move on and be my own voice, not just a Jonathan Pierce impersonator, which is basically what the station wanted.
Funny, I remember when I got tired, I mean, that notion of driving back from Lancashire to London to edit post-match interviews and get them in the carts ready for the breakfast show, that's quite daunting. I never had anything quite as bad as that, but my schedule got pretty bad in the early 2000s where I had a drive time show on BRNB. I had a comedy show called The Barmy Brummies, which I did every Monday to Friday, 4 till 7, which also required about 6 hours of prep to write and record sketches or parody songs. In the midst of that, I'm doing prep for the game that I'm doing for Tom on a Saturday, which could be at home, equally could be a ridiculous drive. So Sunday was my day of, it was a 6 day week, but it was a full on 6 day week. And that probably lasted for about 2 years whilst I was doing drive time. And that was putting the hard yards in, you know, that was where, it's impossible to make time for anything else. Your social life, you realize there and then, was gone.
Yeah, I would say from 91 through to 97, really, my you know, work and social life were the same thing. You know, it was the five or six people who were the main people on Capital Gold. And, you know, we either worked long into the night at football matches, or we would go to the Prince of Wales Feathers round the back of Warren Street Station and stay there until we got lobbed out. You know, it was, didn't see much of anybody else, you know.
And it's strange, isn't it? Because these are so often the hard yards. And yet now we kind of tend to look back, or I certainly tend to look back on, you know, those early local radio days with such fondness, and have had many similar experiences to the two of you. You know, you go and you do whatever kind of game it might be in whatever competition, but it might be a Tuesday night, long distance away from home, it's freezing cold, you know, the game isn't very good, then you've got to kind of drive back, then you've got friends, in my case, you know, I'd kind of recently left university, I had friends who all moved to London, sort of semi-questioning my sanity, saying, you know, what are you doing driving up to, you know, Hartlepool or Plymouth or whatever it may be on a Tuesday night to do that? But ultimately, I think, you know, those hard yards generate, or they did for me at least, generated so much passion for the job that, you know, it's a reminder of why you're doing it. You know, why you're doing it is because we're in a uniquely privileged position. There's no feeling, I don't think, like when it's 15 to 20 minutes to go in a game, it's 2-2, both sides are pushing for a winner towards the end of the season. You know, for me, there's not much that's better than that. And I think, yes, of course, you know, there are nil-nil draws across a season where the game isn't very good. Yes, of course, it can and does have an effect on your social life, your personal life. But, you know, it's in those moments where it's truly exciting that actually you remember kind of what a high we get off this and how we are in such a uniquely privileged position. And I come back to that kind of thing of it's not really work. It's a paid hobby.
So, and you make friends, don't you, for life, I think. You know, I've been in touch with Julian Waters recently, Ian Crocker, you know, another one of the Capital guys who, you know, and suddenly before you know it, you've known these people for 30 years and you've kind of lived parallel lives and a lot of the same experiences. You know, it's you end up feeling a massive amount of affection for these people you shared those experiences with for what ends up very quickly being quite a long time. I keep overplaying the old card here, don't I, Dan? I'm going to be described as veteran commentator for the first time.
but I find it somewhat odd because, you know, I hate to say this almost. I really don't want to emphasize this generational stuff anymore. But I remember, you know, I remember listening to your commentaries. I've heard you both when I was trying to get into the game, when I was still at, you know, university, still at school. And it can be strange sometimes, you know, going into a press box and looking over and thinking that's John Murray or that's whoever it may be. You know, it's that, and that's one of the great things, I suppose, about, you know, the fact that as we said at the start, you know, the intergenerational stuff doesn't really matter because we all muck in and we all get on, and there is that shared level of camaraderie, but there are still moments for me, and I get this sometimes with ex-players, that, you know, you might be working. I was working with Ray Parler, I think, for one of the first times the other day, and I think that's Ray Parler. He's an invincible. You know, there's still that slightly kind of, there are those star-crossed moments, or those you know, those moments where you kind of think, wow, you know, I really am lucky to be doing this, working in and around people that either I've watched play the game or that got me into commentary, you know, kind of got those passions flowing when I was younger and when I had that cassette tape doing commentary off the TV.
Well, we need to know, Joe, at this point, how you made the switch from working for BBC Radio Derby, because obviously you're at TalkSport now, which is where, of course, I work with you, but you do stuff for the World Feed and IMG. So where did the switch come? That must have been fairly recent then.
Well, it was. I finished doing BBC Derby commentaries for Burton in 2017, and it's similar to kind of the pivot points in your career, and you know, those chance opportunities that, you know, Steve talked about when it came to leaving Capital, and I'm sure it was the same as for you, Dance, when you decided to, you know, that you wanted to make the move to Talk Sport. I decided, you know, that 3 years, fantastic experience, but that I wanted to do more. I wanted to see if I could kind of make that leap towards something national. I was already doing commentaries for Perform, which had a base in Feltham, where you'd walk in and there would be 14 different commentary booths, and there'd be people commentating on the Argentinian Premier Division or the Portuguese Senior Cup or something like that. And I was already doing stuff for IMG, and I thought, well, now is the time for me to kind of try and break into doing national reporting. So I stopped doing Burton games. I freed up my Saturdays. I did reporting for Five Live initially, as well as commentaries for local radio, kept my hand in an IMG. And then I started doing games for Talk Sports, reporting matches initially. Naz Premji, who's, again, you know, one of these many lovely people that have such an impact. You know, it's almost like doors open through conversations or through bumping into people who say, you know, I know this guy, or I've got a contact here or there. And it led me to Dave Walker, who was the football editor at TalkSport. And I started doing reports for TalkSport. And very quickly, that developed into commentaries, because, of course, the EFL rights have been with the TalkSport network for some time now, and they were at that stage. And that developed into doing EFL commentaries for TalkSport. And, you know, as so often is the case with these things, it snowballs from there. Suddenly there are Premier League opportunities. And with that in itself, spurns new opportunities with different companies. So I'm now, you know, able to further my work with IMG. I now work for Gravity on the Europa League and the FA Cup games, and for Sky Sports on the Red Button. So it's amazing how kind of one seed of an opportunity, if you like, can lead to so many more things happening. And as has been the case throughout, you know, I've been very lucky with who I've been able to meet and the, you know, the good fortune and the faith that they've shown in me.
Steve, you have that too, because you do World Feed stuff. I hear you lot doing championship games that normally the Friday night game.
I was BBC staff for a long time, 20 years, really. I was on staff, so that doesn't allow you to do anything other than work for the BBC. And I made the decision, following a lot of umming and ahhing, really, but I came off staff after the World Cup in Russia in 2018. So I've been effectively, I have a contract with Match of the Day, but I'm freed up, as long as Match of the Day agree it, to work for other people. Can't work for everyone. BBC wouldn't let me work for some people. Some people wouldn't want me. God knows why, but there you are. So yeah, the last three seasons or whatever it is has been sort of quite an exciting new adventure for me. And I felt I needed it to a certain extent, Dance, is that, you know, I felt, you know, I was like 50 years old, but I still felt and still feel really ambitious. And I just sort of thought, well, you know, fabulous though the last 20 years have been, the next 15 years will only be the same again unless I do something about it. And, you know, that wasn't a terrible prospect, doing another 15 years on staff at the BBC. But I felt that I wanted to still show that I was ambitious and willing to get out there and work for other people. And the joy of it really has been, and I work for, like Joe, I work for IMG, I work for Pitch, I work for Gravity, various people doing Champions League, Internationals, Championship, all kinds of stuff. And the real joy of it actually has been that quite often I'll walk into a production center somewhere and suddenly there'll be a face I worked with 10 years ago at the BBC that I haven't seen for ages. It'd be kind of like, oh, hi, you know, there are BBC people everywhere, basically. Because as you know, when BBC Sport moved to Salford, there was what HR people, with a horrible word, would call it, there was a lot of churn. You know, a lot of people didn't go. These are now the great thing is, you know, you walk in and you kind of go, oh my God, hello, I haven't seen you for a long time. And it's been really good. I have no regrets about that at all. And I think it's been good from a BBC work as well, to be honest with you, because, you know, obviously I used to watch the Champions League and obviously I used to watch the Championship, but there is a difference between watching and working, and you absorb that knowledge of players and clubs and tournaments far more if you're commentating on it than if you're simply watching it. So when I go to the World Cup or the European Championship with the BBC, I feel I'm better prepared because I have watched these players play with that different state of mind, not just watching them as a viewer on the telly, but watching them intently and commentating on them, where you're trying to analyze patterns of running and all that kind of thing, you know, just to recognize people. So
it's very interesting. I need to spread my wings a bit more myself, I think, because there was a time when I was working for UEFA doing Europa League and Champions League commentaries when the lovely Tim White had a contract to provide from Delta Trade. But since that changed, and obviously people like Gravity and other people have picked up the rights, I haven't gone there. I've not sought out that particular avenue. So, you know, because I am Talk Sport and a bit of Planet Rock on the side, you know, for something completely different, as Monty Python would say. But yeah, the opportunities are clearly still out there in varying degrees. And of course, what I've had doing Europa League, somebody in Canada sends you a message, I've just heard you doing Aaron Vane against Ventspils. And I'm at a bar in Vancouver. And that's where, this is nuts. I'm just sat in a little booth in Wimbledon and you're listening to me in Vancouver.
I have to say, Dan, when I left the BBC, when I came off staff at the BBC and went on to contract, I wasn't sure how it was going to go. I think we all have those fears. You know, is anybody actually going to give me a game? And I'm delighted to say that I had a long couple of conversations with Peter Drury about it, and Pete said to me, he said, "Believe me, your problem will be saying no to people, not finding stuff to do." And touch wood, that's been the case. Is that, you know, there's been the football season goes in ebbs and flows, doesn't it? But there's periods of the season where you kind of feel, if you're not disciplined enough to actually say, do you know what, I can't do that, you would end up working every day. And actually, the people who are employing you, they don't want a tired, underprepared Steve Wilson. They want the Steve Wilson that they've heard on Match of the Day, that is totally prepared, has done, you know, a hell of a lot of preparation for that particular game, has you know, absolutely not winged it. You know, now you could take the view that for the extra match fee, oh yeah, of course I can wing that. And you know what, you probably could, but in the long run, and Pete said this and he's bang on, it doesn't do you any favors, because they don't want the half-baked person, they want the fully switched on person.
True. It's very true. Joe, you were about to say something, now I think off the back of me talking about somebody hearing me in Vancouver.
Yes, well, I had a very strange experience recently where I was, this was before Christmas, and I was down at Gravity doing the Europa League. And I think it was Dinamo Zagreb against Rapid Vienna. This was one of the last games of the group stages. Anyway, did the game, didn't think any more of it. And then over Christmas, I had a video call with my uncle who lives out in Dubai, and we were, you know, catching up on all the normal sort of things, and we got to talking about work and how you're getting on with the commentary. And he eventually revealed that he had flicked on the television in Dubai, had no idea what the network would have been, on a random Thursday evening. And lo and behold, there was Dinamo Zagreb against Rapid Vienna. And then on the little ticker tape at the bottom of the screen comes up the words commentator Joe Shennan. And it was the most bizarre sort of coincidence to think that, you know, he's not actually a big football fan. So what he was doing, flicking on the Europa League I don't know what time it would have been in Dubai at that point, possibly the middle of the night, I do not know. But he happened to have switched on at the exact time I was providing the World Feed commentary. So thankfully, it was a decent game. And thankfully, I was well prepped for it. So I think he would have got a decent 90 minutes out of it.
Joe, I have the exact opposite experience that my elderly dad, who I have very much to be thankful for him because he's a massive sports fan. They're not particularly football, but I grew up in a family that, you know, cricket, rugby league, rugby union, you know, grandstand, right, football focus, final score, all those things. You know, we watched any old sport. If sport was on, we watched it. And but my dad, who's now quite elderly, for whatever reason, sits and watches sport with the mute button on. And I was there after the Leeds game on Saturday. I went over to go and see my mum and dad and stay the night and spend a bit of time with them on the Sunday. And sure enough, obviously he's watching sport sort of, you know, 24 hours a day almost, but with the mute button on, you know. And I'm kind of like, Dad, can we hear the commentary? He goes, oh, can't stand that racket. So I was like, Dad, seriously, if everybody thought like that, you know, your son would be out of work.
He'd be out of a job.
Oh, yeah, I can't bear it. But he sits watching sport, hours and hours of sport with the mute button on.
And yet, he custard pies you. When you
absolutely. When I did the FA Cup final the other year for BBC One, you know, I said to him, I said, did you watch it? And he went, yeah, I saw a bit of it. I said, did you put the sound on? Mum put it on for a couple of minutes when she came in from the garden. But when she went outside, I turned it off again. Thanks, Dad.
Yeah, there's love. There's love. Fatherly love. But, you know,
he's from Yorkshire, which explains.
There's probably something in that, isn't there? Yeah, I do wish my dad was still around. My dad was a great source of encouragement and realism, I think, because my dad was the first person I used to call when I left a game. If I've been reporting or commentating, you'd sit in the car, ring the old man, especially if I've been watching Birmingham, because he'd want to know just how bad we'd been. He'd want it confirmed that they were as bad as the scoreline would suggest, because he took some kind of perverted gratification in the fact that Birmingham was still rubbish after he'd stopped going to see them. He suffered one relegation too many, basically, back in the mid-80s. And he then gave up on going down to St Andrews. But periodically, either when I was a broadcaster or just as a fan, I would persuade him, come on, Dad, we're playing Port Vale tonight, or Shrewsbury or something, come down. And he would relent and come and sit with me in the Tilton Cop corner. And 10 minutes in, he turned to me and goes, haven't got any better, have they? And that was it. And he said, this is going to end up 0-0. And he was almost invariably right. And I hated him for it, because he was always had his finger on the pulse of just how bad it was going to be. I do, you know. So, you know, you cherish your folks while they're still around, because whilst your dad custard pies you like that, you know he's immensely proud of you.
Of course he is. No, he is. But it does just make me laugh that he for quite a few years now, he sits and watches TV with the sound off. Not just me, anybody. If it was just me, I might take it a bit more personally. Yeah.
I was wondering. You're literally not alone. Yeah, you don't want to be alone. What about your folks or your family, Joe? Do they give you notes?
They don't give me notes, but look, I've been very similar to you in the sense that, you know, I grew up in a house where the radio was always on, the TV was always on, and I spoke about that kind of, that sense that you take in commentary by a strange kind of osmosis, I think, when you're younger, possibly. And I know that not all routes are the same, and what has been great about listening to the pod dance is hearing people who've got into the business much later after, you know, doing a completely different job, possibly. But I think for a lot of us, you know, or at least even if you don't get into it until later on, you absorb it by listening to the greats, you know, and I've actually, Peter Jones was sadly before my time, but I've found some fantastic old commentary of his on YouTube that I've listened to before. I think it was a random League Cup game between Liverpool and Arsenal, you know, and I think as a commentator, you get to kind of hear about the history of the greats and, you know, to be able to listen to Peter in detail and kind of get a sense of that, that cadence, that rhythm, that vocabulary and that voice, of course, you know, has been fantastic. But I'm like you. I call my dad after every game. Ironically, he's probably one of TalkSport's biggest listeners over the last 5 or 6 years, the number of commentaries that he must have dialed into. But it's a fantastic, you know, ability to be able to speak to somebody, to be able to get really good advice back. And I have a number of people that, you know, you look at and you call mentors. Charlie Runcie, who we've already talked about. Rob Knopfman, who's been absolutely amazing. Rob Hawthorne, who's given me some really good advice, and many others too. And you cannot underestimate the impact of the advice from people.
Steve Wilson doesn't know this, but he was one of the first people, Joe, to come up to me and say my name to me, as you know, in a press box. I can remember it, Steve. I was at Molyneux in that press room on the on the second floor, and I couldn't tell you who Wolves were playing, but it was in my early days of Talk Sport, Joe. So I wasn't a commentator quite so much at this point. I think it was in my early days of being just a reporter. I didn't graduate to commentary until 2 years after I joined in 2006. But Steve actually came up and introduced himself. I think the long hair I had at the time might have been a giveaway. He's like, "You're Ian Dancer, aren't you?" I'm Steve from Match. And that was, oh, God, the bloke from Match. Please.
But you know what? One of Joe's predecessors at Radio Derby is Arlo White. And Arlo now does, you know, Premier League for NBC with Graham Lasso and Lee Dixon and stuff. And Arlo, I remember Arlo as a very young kid. I was at Pride Park at a Five Live reporting game, I think, and Arlo was there. And he came up to me. He's working with Colin Gibson at Radio Derby. And he came up to me and he said, I think at the time he was kind of shadowing or something. I'm not really sure what he was doing. But Arlo tells me, though I have no memory of it, apparently he wrote to me and I wrote him back a sort of a 5-page handwritten guide on how to get into football commentary, apparently. I mean, that's remarkable in itself because of my handwriting's appalling. But it becomes a bit weird when people who are kind of, I don't know how old Arlo is, but, you know, people who are sort of, you know, broadcasting across a country as large as the United States on NBC, you know, sort of say like, oh yeah, you know, when I was little, you wrote me a letter.
You used all your English literature and language skills there in that 5-page missive.
I wonder what I said. I can't remember, but it is important. And I do find it encouraging to hear that basically from Joe, that, you know, the best ways are still ultimately, you know, doing things like hospital radio, university radio, whatever, you know, local paper, go out and do stuff for nothing, you know, and yes, there's a certain amount of privilege in being able to work for nothing, obviously. But I don't think I got paid. I was going in Saturday mornings into Capital, spending Saturdays at Capital Radio for some months before anyone ever thought I might want some money for it, you know. And unfortunately, that's kind of, you know, having a degree is all very well in broadcast media or whatever, but there are a hell of a lot of people with that piece of paper. What can you do which rises you above everybody else?
The guy's job at BRNB and Capital Gold, who I was forever bowing and scraping to, was a guy called Martin Simpson, who would have, on a typical Saturday, we'd have 5 reel-to-reel machines in front of him with all 5 games going on at once. So Birmingham, Villa, Albion, Wolves and Walsall. 5 commentaries at once. That guy had a sixth sense for knowing where a goal had gone in to get that goal off the reel, clip it and have it ready to be played out on air. I mean, it was just, to watch him was like poetry in motion. I only ever got to see him do it once or twice because, of course, I was on the other end of an ISDN line most of the time. But on the occasions that I watched Martin do his job, that's amazing work. That's way beyond me, just verbal diarrhea.
And do you know what, Dan? I mean, the generosity of some people in the industry with their time and, you know, with being willing to teach you. You know, when I first got a little foot in the door unpaid at Capital Radio, there was a guy there called Andrew Dolby, who then moved back to Durham, and I think he was involved in Durham Cricket Club. But, you know, I had no radio training whatsoever. And he said, right, okay, you need to be in at 11 or whatever to sort of, you know, do your making cups of tea and whatever. And he goes, but if you want to come in at 9, I will show you how to edit quarter-inch tape, what leader is. You know, I will show you how the cart machine works, I knew a little bit about a radio desk. But he spent a couple of hours every Saturday for quite a few weeks just basically teaching me technically how radio worked. And, you know, he got nothing out of it other than the pleasure, I suppose, of being able to help somebody on their way. You know, thank God for Andrew Dolby and the people like him, you know?
That lovely. That's so
because there is there's no substitute, is there? Sorry, Dance, for that, for those air miles and that experience. As Steve said, I don't think there's a right or wrong way. You know, I think you can, I'm sure you can succeed with say a media degree or a journalism degree. I'm sure you can succeed without it. But what I think we all know is there's no substitute for those on the ground air miles, if you like, that propel you forward. And just on you know, the help that you receive in your career at various points, and I don't think you ever really stop learning. But before Euro 2020, or the delayed Euro 2020, which was my first major tournament, I wrote to my commentary hero, Mike Ingham. And I asked Mike just for some, you know, simple advice, you know, said, hello, never spoken to you before, but it'd be lovely to hear your thoughts on, you know, what I can do to prep for this tournament, what I'm doing wrong, what I can get better at. And in the end, he gave me a sort of full multi-paragraph review of a piece of 20 minutes of football commentary that I'd sent him of, I think, a Forest against Leeds game. And it was surreal enough just being in conversation with the man that I had, you know, kind of like my 11-year-old kid coming out again, going back to that person that I'd heard on the radio that had developed that passion within me for the industry. It was surreal enough speaking to him in one sense, but then getting that level of feedback was so greatly appreciated. And I want to mention Alan Green as well, who once on the day of a commentary that he had, I can't remember where it was, I think it might have been at Arsenal, on the day of a commentary, he spared me an hour of his time when I was still in local radio, still just out of university, to give some advice, to give some pointers, to give some tips. And, you know, I don't think you could ever underestimate the generosity of people like that. And I think as you've both said, you know, what did they necessarily get out of it themselves? Well, you know, as individuals, but perhaps nothing. But to kind of pass on that information, you know, I think it really means a lot, things like that. And it's those things that you take forward and you know, you can hopefully pass on to other people yourselves.
I've learnt loads about football from Mike King and the Chief, and loads about where to shop for vinyl as well. Hunt down. He's a specialist in many areas, is Mike, and he's sadly missed, I think. He's enjoying his retirement, as he was on the previous episode of this podcast, and it was a delight to speak to him. But the Chief is the perfect description. I guess we're running out of time, chaps. We really should wrap things up because we've been talking for well over an hour. You guys both support teams that are pushing well at the top of their respective divisions. Wickham, I know, is your love, Joe, and every chance that they could get back to the Championship for the first time of asking.
I hope so, because the great shame of the only season that we've ever spent in the Championship was that there were no fans there to see it. Behind closed doors and, you know, all the unfortunate stuff at the end of the season where they rallied but couldn't quite make it. So things are looking good. The new ownership have done terrific things for the club. Crowds are up. I'm going to get to go there this weekend, actually, because I got the weekend off. So I'm going to go and see his take on MK Dons, which is a real rarity, as you both know. You know, the Saturdays off during the season are very much few and far between.
Is that classed as a derby fixture?
I was wondering exactly the same thing.
We have a strange relationship with the word derby, because our traditional local derby is with Colchester United. And of course, it's not local at all, but it all goes back to trouble at an FA Cup tie back in the early 90s. And ever since then, both clubs have sort of hated each other. So while we have what you might call local rivalries, Oxford, MK Dons, they're not really proper derby matches. Wickham Colchester is one of the more quirky derby matches, if you like.
Like a Palace Brighton thing, I suppose.
Except Wickham, it's not named after a motorway.
Yeah,
Wickham and Reading sounds like the game that would stir up passions in a Waitrose car park, wouldn't it?
I do miss the days when Waitrose were sponsoring Reading, because the tucker in the press room was just that little bit higher quality in terms of the sausage rolls. Actually, Wickham's one of my favourite commentaries I've ever done, Joe. I did the Wickham Spurs Cup tie at White Hart Lane.
Oh,
it was about 5 years ago now, when Eric Dyer just didn't know what to do against Adebayo Akinfenwa, and it took Son Heung-min to knock you out in the last seconds. That was an amazing... Alvin Martin was sat next to me. Absolute incredulity as he's looking at Wickham bossing Spurs for an hour. In fact, I think it was when Akinfenwa went off with a little thigh problem. That was the route back into the tie for Spurs. If he'd stayed on for the full 90, I think you'd have knocked him out that day.
I think the sheer presence of Adebayo Akinfenwa is enough to... His uniqueness is enough to unsettle just about any defender. I mean, one thing that would be great one day, wouldn't it, Dance, would be to be able to commentate on Wickham in a Premier League game or something like that. You know, I'm really getting ahead of myself here, but that would be that would be quite remarkable. But look, the club is at the moment, touch wood, you know, the club is being well run on and off the field, and in Gareth Ainsworth, you know, one of the great EFL managers of recent times. So it's all going swimmingly.
Just make sure you get up properly rather than on a points per game basis. Otherwise, Adrian Jones is going to come after you again.
Let's not get into that.
Yeah, let's not. Steve, it's Tranmere for you. And I'm actually going to Prenton Park this weekend.
I know.
For the game. Forest Green, the first two in the division. And you know, Mickey Mellon back again up on the Wirral. You know, Tranmere have been... Well, my memories of Tranmere go back to us playing you in the old Leyland Daffin.
Yes, I was there.
I
was there. My Tranmere odyssey started, I suppose, in 1975, when my dad's brother and I went to go and watch them play Grimsby. I'm actually doing a Tranmere podcast next week, so one of the questions was my first ever game, and I found the programme for the game, which cost 6p. I've only got about two football programmes, but that's one of them. And Steve Coppell was on the wing for Tranmere. And you know, I once, later when he was the Crystal Palace manager, I used to do a bit of writing for 90 Minutes Football magazine, which was one of the great kind of football magazines of its time. Paul Hawksby, obviously, was involved. Dan Goldstein, Dave Cottrell, who I knew at school. So I interviewed Steve Coppell. And the piece in 90 Minutes, they put a headline on it, The Graduate, because he was famously an economics graduate at Liverpool University. A bit like Steve Highway, really, who went on to play for Liverpool. Anyway, so the thrust of the interview really was about Palace. But obviously, being a Tranmere fan, I sort of talked a little bit about that and how he and Ronnie Moore were my kind of first footballing heroes, I suppose. And he was sold to Manchester United at the end of that season, and in his first season at Manchester United, they reached the FA Cup final, losing to Southampton, the Bobby Stokes final. And he told me that on the Saturday he played for Manchester United in the FA Cup final, and on the Monday he started his final exams in economics at Liverpool University. Can you imagine?
Oh, dear, bad times have changed. Goodness me. I hope he got his. I hope he got his qualifications after all that.
You know, oh yes, yeah.
You've got to have a trade to fall back on, haven't you? You've got to have a trade. you know, just doesn't work out.
I mean, ironically, studying economics, well, obviously these days, if you know anything about economics and football, then, you know, they'd say pack in the economics and concentrate on football, you know. But yes, so very, very similar, really, to what Joe's just been saying about Wickham. We've got a great manager in Mickey Mellon. We've got great owners in Mark and Nicola Palios. They've done some investing this week. We've been on a fabulous run over the last probably 2 or 3 months, 10, 11 games, I think it is, unbeaten in the league, winning most of them. And top two go up. So I'm feeling unusually confident, but I've just cursed it, haven't I?
I shouldn't talk about points per game with you either, because you suffered the other way.
Tranmere were relegated on the basis of about 0.05 of a point or something in the pandemic. It was one of the great injustices of football all time. But if you want to know chapter and verse on that, speak to Nigel Adderley.
Oh yeah, Nigel could give me a dissertation.
I think he still spends 2 hours a day talking about it.
He probably does. Listen, lads, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for giving up your time to talk to me on the podcast. It's been a pleasure to hear your journeys and your stories. Good luck for the rest of the season. Joe, I'm sure I'll see you somewhere. Likewise, Steve, like I saw you at Ellen Road last Saturday, I'm sure our paths will cross in a press room somewhere. Now that the press rooms are opening up again, then we might actually be able to sit down and have a 5-10 minute chat, which we've all missed, haven't we?
We have. Yes, we have. Yeah. It's been a pleasure, Dan. Thank you very much.
Well, listen,
it's been really terrific.
Joe, thank you, and all the best for the rest of the season. And we'll wrap it up there. Thanks for listening to the Commentator's Curse. Joe Shannon and Steve Wilson, my guests. My thanks to those guys. Keep listening. There'll be more to come somewhere down the track with the next episode with another two of my commentary colleagues on the Commentator's Curse.